This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run begins its ascent. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. It, of course, is the 20th of October, and it's a Friday.
Good morning, folks.
Good morning. On the eve of weekends, I think our minds often divided between what is now and what can be.
Well, I think that is certainly true for myself. I mean, I've been off the airwaves for the first few days of this week.
And you were missed, literally hundreds and thousands of letters poured in.
Oh, really? Handwritten letters.
Absolutely. Very analog. I think you inspired that segment of the population.
No, but once again, I have plenty of time to contemplate, about the here and now versus what's to come, that being today. Looking ahead to the weekend already.
Okay. Somebody who might not be looking towards the weekend is Parti Warisan Sabah President Shafiq Abdal. He was arrested by the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission around 9 p.m. yesterday, some hours after giving a statement to at the MACC office in Kota Kinabalu. He is the subject of many front page stories at this morning newspapers. We'll get to that later.
Also in other news, you have the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, who said that Malaysian militant Mahmud Ahmad, who was tipped to become the new leader of the Islamic State in Southeast Asia, he has been killed. So he confirmed this at a press conference yesterday, and this is according to local news reports in the Philippines.
Yeah, Mahmud Ahmad was former lecturer at University Malaya. Also in the news, 43 Afghan soldiers were killed and 9 wounded after 2 suicide bombers in a Humvee destroyed a military base in Kandahar, establishing that, that the war in Afghanistan continues in many different forms.
And over into Europe, European Council President Donald Tusk has explicitly ruled out any EU action over Catalonia as Spain moves to strip the region of its autonomy. You have Madrid now considering what's called the nuclear option, about really stepping in and make sure that Catalonia does not go ahead with its promise to secede from from Spain, really.
Yeah, Catalonia has not received much support within the European Union either. I think France and Emmanuel Macron came out some weeks ago to say that if Catalonia decides on independence, it will be out of the European Union. So giving no solace to that quarter. Also in the news, New Zealand is set for a centre-left coalition government led by Labour head Jacinda Ardern, the youngest prime minister for New Zealand in about 150 years. She is 37 years old.
So obviously the age profile of these, world leaders are slowly coming down, closer to my age bracket. On one hand, it's like, yay for the young people, we are taking over the world. But at the same time, makes me wonder, what am I doing with my life?
Okay, well, great that you bring it back to yourself. I think that's because it's a lot that distinguishes her from her Austrian counterpart. I think likely to be president of that country at the tender age of 32, also said to be one of the world's youngest leaders. But having said that, it's really policy that really matters in this regard.
Yeah, but still, Macron, 39 years old. You look at Trudeau, you look at I think in Ireland, is it? What's the name? Yeah. Anyways, yeah. Regardless, age profile coming down. Yay for the Generation Y taking over the world.
It's inevitable, I guess, to hand over the reins of power to the next generation. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was The Passenger by James Bay. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. And time to talk about boys and girls, especially since a school in the UK started offering its GCSE English classes to male and female students separately. The reason? Girls have been faring much better academically compared to boys. Here's the school's head teacher, Jason Ashley, explaining why they decided to separate their students by gender.
We just simply look at what works. We don't have any political beliefs about the curriculum or the political beliefs about teaching. Ultimately, we will always look to corral anything that kind of works identify how it works and then try and learn from it. And, you know, 8 weeks in, I'm very, very impressed with how it's going.
That was head teacher Jason Ashley from the Redbridge Community School, speaking behind interviewed at a disco, a local disco. I don't know what that was.
Well, you can
the
blame
in the background.
Yeah, you can blame the BBC video for that music bed there. But Sharad, I think the question here is, now, given what's being conducted at the Redbridge Community School, you know, amid this broader push for gender neutrality, right? We are seeing gender neutral pronouns, toys, you know, socialization, bathroom events, right? Amidst all that, is there still room to, say, recognize the differences between these sexes? Like, where do you actually draw this line?
Well, I mean, here we have an instance where the difference is about performance, and clearly boys doing worse off than girls. Even in this country, if you look at scholastic achievements, girls do much better than boys. And there it's clear that, well, I mean, you can make the argument that girls are just smarter, one, or that girls are, conform better and are much more disciplined because of kind of cultural constraints of ideals about being a girl as opposed to ideals about being a boy. Boys are encouraged to be carefree and slightly reckless and irresponsible, where girls are always taught to be responsible, think of others, be disciplined, be reliable. You know, all those things that actually make for you doing well in school and perhaps in life generally, and maybe, you know, helping the species continue.
Right. And just to bring you some numbers from the UK Department of Education. So in the 2016-2017 school year in the UK, over 42% of the girls scored higher than a C grade for English and math, while for the boys, that was 36%. So only about 1 in 3 boys scored higher than a C for English and math. So once again, it's about, you know, because these students at this GCSE levels, they have already been socialized to exhibit those traits that you mentioned earlier, right? And some may be rather anti-school or may not be as conducive to a formal school environment. Now, then do you pander to them and then have these kind of segregated approach when it comes to making sure that they improve academically? Or do you then try and still push that gender-neutral approach? In other words, you know, are they really at risk of being disadvantaged given this segregated approach?
You know, I think, and there's something that the head teacher talked about, saying that, you know, we're not following any politically correct move in this regard. They're just looking for outcomes. And the nature versus nurture on the question of, girls doing better. I mean, it might be that girls beyond culture are just, you know, wired to be smarter than boys. I mean, that might be true too. But I do think in this regard, how do we deal with problems? Yesterday I was watching a TV program about Istanbul or Turkey introducing, segregated buses, only because men behave so badly with women in public places. Now, some of the women they interviewed, this was a bad thing because it didn't push men to kind of level up and behave better in public. It just kind of contained the problem. And is that one of the things, you know? And this is the other issue, right? So, can we get boys to perform as well as they can in a co-ed context, or do we have to just concede that this is not possible and therefore go for segregation?
I mean, real quick, you know, for the record, Sharad, you and I both came from all-boy secondary schools, and look at us, we turned out just fine.
Exemplary. Exemplary, I say. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Aeroplane by Red Hot Chili Peppers. I'm sure it couldn't with me, Tan Chung Han. And so much to be said in that pregnant pause there. is there a future for science fiction and fantasy in Malaysia? That seems like a rather arcane question, a question that might be limited to a very small group of people. But this question is being debated, was debated on a blog post by Aswan Mazan, and it's now making rounds on the internet. So it's kind of gone viral. It's kind of perhaps spilt over the borders that it would otherwise be contained by. He answers in the negative, and the reason being Malaysians are discouraged to ask the question, what if or why not? This culture of mindset in turn leads to a devaluation of genres like science fiction and fantasy. BFM spoke to Aswan and asked him what he meant when he said we devalue the science fiction and fantasy genre here.
When these things get devalued, when the function of genres like science fiction and fantasy get devalued and become very light commodities, and this is in general, not local science fiction, not local fantasy, but science fiction and fantasy as genres become nothing more than empty shells. If we have this mindset that, oh, you know, I mean, people make up stuff and put it on a screen and that's all it is. It's just make-believe. But I believe that science fiction and fantasy allows for projecting ideas into your stories, into your narratives. And I fully believe that the Malaysian creative community is doing that. But when the inherent value of their work is socially discounted, and in extreme cases, I guess, subject to legal action, then it's a problem for science fiction and fantasy as functional genres to thrive.
We asked Aswan what he thinks causes this devaluation.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's kind of bad form to like openly talk about the possibility of having a Chinese prime minister, for instance, an ethnic Chinese Malaysian prime minister, I mean. It's borderline seditious to even speak at length about, you know, a different belief system. So when something as fundamental as that receives backlash, receives pushback, when a female Muslim medical professional is not judged based on her merits as a medical professional, but due to the fact that she doesn't wear hijab, those things become a problem for everyone.
That was a freelance writer, Aswan Mazan, who started a bit of a storm in a teacup by asking the question of whether, you know, science fiction and fantasy as genres in writing can and storytelling can actually flourish in Malaysia.
I mean, I can kind of see where he's coming from, given that, and this is really broadly speaking here, okay, that we inculcate a higher dose of realism when it comes to our everyday lives, be it humor, be it how we approach, you know, taboo subjects, etc. It's we understand the sensitivities and then we make do with it, as opposed to trying to push the boundaries, right? As I presume Aswan is trying to champion here.
Yeah, you know, so he gives the example of a Chinese prime minister, right? So if you can't even contemplate that, if that's not even something that every child going to school is asked, you know, would you, you know, do you dream of becoming, you know, a prime minister of Malaysia? Is same in the US, it'd be like president of the United States, right? And this whole idea that everybody can, the system somehow allows it, despite the history of, say, the Ku Klux Klan lynching in the US. I mean, still, you know, the idea is that every kid can dream in that way. In Malaysia, we actively stop kids from dreaming in real sense, right? So if you can't even dream of a Chinese prime minister, how can you dream of, say, an android as prime minister? How can you begin to really go beyond the boundaries that would set it up as science fiction rather than just being, a political scenario?
Right. And I certainly see the value in dreaming, to use that verb that you use there. But then, I mean, just for the sake of discussion here, how do you then find that balance between, say, this constant dreaming and then that perhaps being fodder for your discontent for the current state for way things are versus being more pragmatic? These are the way things are. We make do and then we just go about our lives and perhaps find satisfaction via other avenues.
I mean, you know, let's look at Hollywood as a kind of propaganda machine, right? I mean, for years, Hollywood had an African-American president, years before Obama even emerged, right? And the idea that, you know, popular culture and fiction can anticipate something of the future.
Or even drive social change.
And even drive, right? Yeah. Because it normalizes it. It makes it possible. It makes it thinkable. It makes it unproblematic. And this is the way in which, I guess, you know, even in the question of, gender neutrality that we talked about earlier, you know, the very famous famous science fiction writer and anthropologist Ursula Le Guin, you know, in her book called A Left Hand of Darkness, talks about a world in which having had sex, men and women, in that coupling, it's unclear who's going to have, could become pregnant.
Oh.
Now, imagine that scenario. If you're not certain who's going to be pregnant, it changes gender dynamics radically. I mean, radically, right? And so her idea of thinking the impossible and looking through the consequences is where, you know, it's at, I think, in terms of science fiction. Mm-hmm. More on that. If you want to join this conversation, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Now, Talking Heads, Road to Nowhere, taking us somewhere, actually. It's taking us to 6:30 in the first bulletin of the day, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Modest Mouse, Float On, just before the ad. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Tan Chung Han. Time to talk about vocational schools. Apparently, vocational training institutes are losing the stigma they once had as the place for underachievers. This is especially in view of the number of jobless university graduates remain high. In August, the Higher Education Minister, Idris Yusuf, said that nearly 55,000, or some 22%, of the 236,000 graduates that we have were jobless within 6 months upon completing their undergraduate studies. And this figure comes from both public universities as well as private colleges. BFM spoke to Adeline Fu, the founder of the Automotive College. The Automotive College, or TOC is otherwise known, is a school that offers automotive and motorsport education, which was established in 2005. BFM asked Adeline whether the perception towards vocational schools has changed in the last decade.
Yes, in the past decade, I believe I have seen some positive reaction towards vocational, but it's not enough. So I think as a nation, we can do more. But it really takes government intervention to change the mindset completely.
We also asked Adeline how much of a pushback comes from parents of children and what she usually says to address their concerns.
We can tell the parents that, first of all, you should let the kid do what he's passionate about. So if the kid, whether it's a son or a daughter, wants to pursue automotive, they should let them. But I think most children's first priority is to please the parents. So if the kid likes it very much, but if the parents don't like it, they would still choose to do something else that they could settle for or bear with, but their parents are completely proud of them. So we've had some girls who are really good or some students who are really good and they want to take up this, but the parents wouldn't let them.
We also asked if she thinks that parents would be more receptive if they knew that pursuing something like automotive studies would ensure a stable financial future for their children.
I mean, definitely. I mean, for TOC, for example, 100% of our students have a job before they graduate. Even in the first year, they start earning more than a graduate would earn. But sometimes for parents, having the kid graduate from something is worth more for the picture taking or the bragging to the friends than the kid having a job after he graduates. I mean, nobody really talks about, oh, my son is hired by who, but where my son graduated from. I think somehow that perception is still very much in the Asian society. And again, I think this is based on the education system that has to change. If from the very beginning we do not have academic-based examinations that screen the failing people into vocational, then this perception wouldn't be there. So until that changes, I think the perception would still be vocational is for failure. But at the end of the day, every job that we need done in the world, whether it is fixing the light or fixing the car or fixing the washing machine, all these things that we need our everyday life is done by somebody who do something with their hands. So, of course, vocational graduates get jobs.
That was Adeline Fu, founder of the Automotive College, making a passionate plea for us to rethink the way, rethink where vocational education is in the scheme of things.
Yeah, certainly when she highlighted the social stigma that may still be attached to vocational training, I think that is a major part when it comes to perhaps some resistance or reluctance by students to maybe pursue that. And I think she highlighted students wanting to pander to what their parents actually want them to be. I mean, so
and
often
also what
hear,
parents want to, you know, boxes that parents want to put their children
in.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
So often these parents, you know, want to live vicariously through their kids, you know, given the plethora of educational choices that are available to their kids now that may not have been available to them, you know, during their time.
I think the whole situation, frankly, is very messed up. And I think it's led by educational institutions that is largely businesses where, you know, the person who is advising you is really a salesperson, not, you know, a professional who understands to assess, you know, educational needs. And I think, and I've been to educational fairs, I think they're quite a disaster when it comes to clear thinking about education. What they are is really an industry that's pushing for more bums and seats.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is a case to be made about how with vocational training, you learn one set of skill sets, whereas with a more liberal, a graduate degree or with a more liberal education, more liberal college education, you then are opened up to a diverse set of career choices.
Only if the quality of that liberal education is high. And that's where
that just
it
keeps going
fails miserably. There's just a lot of bogus stuff out there. Anyway, that's my opinion. If you have an opinion, you can always join this conversation. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Living for the City by Stevie Wonder. Tan Chung Han and myself, Sharad Kutin, and the morning run continues. Just coming up to 7 o'clock, we have 8 minutes to go before we hit the top of the hour. It is the 20th of October. Remember, you can always join us in the conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. We were talking about education, something that we're all very passionate about, something that parents spend tons of money on for their children, and sometimes with little effect. So the question is, where are we going wrong? And we were just talking about vocational education is a real option. It produces jobs for those who graduate from it, so say some advocates. And it actually is so important, part of the kind of ecosystem of education, but it's been stigmatized and downgraded and devalued for the longest time.
Now, I think I wouldn't quite frame it as, you know, asking it as where did we go wrong, because when looking at the prospects for the current batch of students, right, it is so uncertain. There is a tremendous amount of disruption that's going on out there. And also, you know, given the seemingly conflicting goals that can be achieved post-graduation. So if, let's say, you are getting a degree for the sake of employment versus, say, getting a degree to, you know, develop yourself and try to find, you know, enhancement that way, then, you know, I think that is perhaps a more constructive way to frame the discussion.
Well, I mean, if you look at all the kind of advertising we get from private education institutions, they always advertise the jobs. So the jobs are always there in the mix, right? There's get your degree quickly, get it cheaply, and get a job for certain at the end of it. And that is the way in which parents are pulled into the, you know, into thinking that this is a sure win for their kids.
Right.
But so much of the quality of private higher education institutions are quite low. And I think that and what they what passes for, you know, so-called humanities or broad-based education, you know, liberal education, in fact, isn't. It's just, you know, I think a failure to really understand what is required, not just to get jobs, what is required to get kids communicating well, thinking analytically, and such.
Right. And going back to that earlier notion that you espoused there about, you know, making sure that you can get that job quickly right after graduation.
What's the advertising?
Well, okay, what does the advertising? And I think that would especially ring true for the vocational training, because you have that specific skill set and then you go work in an industry and that's it. But then what if that industry gets disrupted? Then what? You know, if let's say you go along...
there are no real guarantees. Right. But the point really is this, right? Vocational education is taking you through a kind of hands-on process to do something,
right?
Whereas so much of the other stuff, and I did a liberal arts. But the liberal arts only works when it's really high-quality stuff. And then you go out communicating, you know, very well and having a really kind of rigorous analytical, training so that your mind's really sharp so you can then go into all kinds of areas. But if it's badly done, then you're better off learning something like plumbing and motor mechanics, where you would have gotten real practical skills, where it's very clear what the thing is. And, you know, I think so much of that is missing. And it's a lack of balance, I think, in the education system that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, certainly. But, you know, one could almost frame this as saying that with vocational training, you're putting all your eggs into one basket, say, be it plumbing or automotive work, you know, it's manufacturing, or perhaps with a more liberal college experience, you can then hopefully spread your eggs in different baskets. So, I mean,
but
now
there might be no eggs.
The quality of the eggs is up for debate here, but at least you are kind of given that room, because otherwise,
I think a lot of empty baskets. That's what I see.
I mean, what kind of framework? There's no frame. Okay, we can agree on this. Okay, there's no framework that guarantees success one way or the other.
Well. That's something to come back to. Tell us what you think. You can remember, you can tweet us or you can WhatsApp us. Taking us all the way up to 7, The Beach Boys and Surfing Safari, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. It's just a little past 6 after 7 in the morning, and it's on the 20th of October, because, you know, we're racing towards the end of the year. Very exciting prospects. For those, I think a lot of kids going to finishing up the school year, getting the exams done at this point in time. Now, in another education-related story, we turn to an article from the Malaysian Insight on the issue of school dropouts. The MySkills Foundation says that children dropping out of schools is most prevalent among low-income households, but the lack of detailed statistics makes it hard for welfare organizations to assist affected families. We spoke to the director of the MySkills Foundation, Mr. Pasupathi Sithamparam, and to help us give some context to the severity of the issues, we asked him for statistics on the number of Indian students who enrolled in Standard 1 and how many of them sit for the SPM at the end of this trajectory.
Actually, it's quite interesting, you know, because in 2010, 2011, we did a research, and we realized at the time, you know, in the research we did, about 35,000 students who entered Standard 1, only 28,000 reached SPM. It means about 7,000 dropout. And this roughly is a national average, you know, it's about 20% dropout before reaching SPM. But this being a sensitive data, not many of them advocate or take it further on this point. But even now, there's number of students entering Tamil school, Kebangsaan school, or Chinese school. There are quite a number of students in Chinese school. And basically about 20% of them drop out before reaching SPM for various reasons. So you can safely say 20% of the Indian students drop out before reaching SPM, and roughly about 1,000 students are drop out even before Standard 6 exam.
Now, with this large number of of students falling out of the system, we asked Pasupathi what he thinks, or who he thinks is responsible largely for remedying the situation.
Okay, if you ask, my opinion would be Ministry of Education. They must work together with Ministry of Human Resources and Ministry of Youth and Sports. The resources should be properly used, because Human Resources got a certain amount of allocation. Ministry of Youth and Sports also run skills colleges. And Human Resources run skills colleges. Even Ministry of Education also run skills colleges. Community colleges comes under them. So all these three ministries must work together, must form a task force, and must seriously address this problem, dropping out. You see, if we seriously address this problem, then the over-dependence on foreign labor can be reduced. Another thing, because if these three the ministries work together, then the salaries for these students who after Form 5, after completing the skills training, when they go into factories and all that, they must be given better salary and all that. I think one of the reasons why our students don't go into even skills colleges, even they come out from there, when they go in, they get salary of 1,000, 1,200, which is more or less what is earned by a Bangladeshi worker or Pakistani worker. So that puts up a lot of these students, you know.
We also asked Mr. Pasupathi how to address this issue, considering it's a kind of a generational issue.
Just last year, 2016, one day before Deepavali, Gasana Research Institute, KRI, by Dr. Muhammad Khalid, he released his Climbing the Ladder, Social Mobility Among Malaysians. He revealed a lot of statistics. I think many Indians are not happy after reading that. It shows, let's say the parents are not don't have any formal education. If we put our parents don't have any formal education, chances of the children reaching university, you know, is about 33%. For Chinese, it's about 44%. For Indians, it's only 5%, you know. Okay? And let's say the skill, you look at the skill training, if the parents, let's say the parents don't have proper high skill, a chance of Wimputra parent producing a high skill children is 25%. For the Chinese, it's 39%. For Indians, it's 19%. So it simply shows the socio-economic background, particular race, determines the social mobility of the children. So you find the poverty, the socioeconomic background, the lack of opportunities, the apathy. So the parents, what happens, they can't really create an enabling environment for the children. So results will be the children don't really get good education. So to me, it's simply the simple reason would be the socioeconomic background determines. And then, of course, there are so many reasons I can attribute. The Indian middle class don't acknowledge such a problem exists within Indians. The Indian politicians so far, they put in so much emphasis on university education, doesn't cater for the bottom 40. So when the thinking and all that has not changed, and that has resulted on this slump.
That was Mr. Pasupathi Sindaram, the director of My Skills Foundation, an organization that aids at-risk youth. Mm. And I guess at risk from crime and maybe for, kind of dropping out of school as well. It's a very interesting discussion there. And now that we have some numbers, it seems that you can put things in perspective. So there is an ethnic dimension to the problem, but it's definitely a class issue when it comes to not just low skills and then therefore low wages, but also this replication of it over generations.
That's right. And I think what we're also reaffirming here is, and this is something that is being espoused in sociology textbooks in high schools across the world as well, whereby home factors play a much larger role when it comes to determining the, at least the academic excellence or, you know, by extension, employment or the employability of these graduates, right? Home factors being the parents' attitudes towards education, your socioeconomic background, even cultural capital, family status, etc. Those actually go a long ways as opposed to, you know, sheer grit, because, I mean, at least in terms of determining social mobility via academic routes.
Yeah, so but the numbers that he gave in the last clip suggest that even if you come from a disadvantaged position, you can, you can move up the ladder, as it were. Now, but it differs depending on the ethnic community that you're from. So then the question is, what is it about the ethnic community? Is that a cultural issue? Is it that there's race discrimination in this country that results in this? Or is it that those communities, depending, so say, for instance, it's highest, I mean, the opportunities for success or the likelihood of success despite your disadvantage is greater with the Chinese community. Is it because the Chinese community has networks and organizations that fill the void, that take up what government does not do or has left behind? You know, with the Bumiputra community, the expectation, of course, is that the state is heavily invested in the success of Bumiputra children, and therefore even your disadvantage doesn't impede you from success in the next generation. Whereas for the Indians, they perhaps lack both state support as well as social networks and, you know, resources beyond the state. So that might be the situation.
Yeah, I think so. You know, because again, going back to those numbers that Mr. Pathi just mentioned earlier, 33% of Bhumis will reach the uni level if their parents have had no formal education, as opposed to the Chinese, who have had no formal education, there's a 44% chance of them actually going up to the uni-level level. So obviously the broader social context here and social values, I guess that stereotype, you know, is not misplaced, you know, whereby like the Chinese community is just so kiasu and it places such a heavy emphasis on education. And it shows, the numbers then reflect that. Recently in The Star, there's this article about how this family in Johor is willing to make their kids wake up at 4 a.m., wait for the school bus, and to make that hop across to Singapore to go and study over there. And they spend something to the tune of 55,000 ringgit for their two kids, ages 9 and 12, I believe. So it's still in primary school level.
This is not a poor family then?
Yeah, it's not. But again, it's that that cultural bias, if I may term it that way.
Yeah, but you see, we're not talking about people who already have those resources. We're talking about people who don't have resources. So despite being disadvantaged, right? So
but you still see that disparity between the various ethnic groups.
So then the question is, where is it come from? Is it cultural? Is it social in terms of resources? Mm. Or is it, in fact, a question of whether the state is biased towards one community or another in terms of aid? So all these things might be part of the mix. I do think it's very interesting that he mentioned the Indian middle class. I guess I'm from that middle class. He says, doesn't acknowledge that the problem exists. And he says, more importantly, that politicians have focused largely on university education. You could see the propaganda value, as it were, of focusing on university education's done a lot in this country without looking at those who are left behind. You know, we don't see people and political parties especially touting a vocational education. It tends to be the other end of the spectrum. And then the middle class values might be the ones that are shaping this.
Right, exactly. Because as we have seen with the numbers from the KRI, the affirmative action policies, they only go so far.
Okay. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.